It's been one of those weeks. I have a sick baby at home and a whole class full of sick undergraduates. And so it's made it hard to concentrate on the sick problem at hand. So I'm going to do something that I haven't really tried before, which is to give a talk with absolutely no preparation, except for the various arguments that I've had with a few of you over the past week or so. Steve asked me if I wanted to give a talk here, and I said, maybe, and he said, okay, you're scheduled. So Chris has spent the last year trying to sort of suck me into this vortex of solving the existence problem of sick POVMs. And I keep responding, I spent a year and a half of my life on that. Okay, all right. So I'm steadfastly not thinking about that problem. Honest, I'm not. But I have been thinking about some other things that I hope will be interesting or relevant. And so since this is a workshop, this is going to be very much a workshop talk, I'm going to throw up the sort of things that I've been thinking about and hope that they stimulate discussion. So please interrupt, jump in, view this as sort of a guided discussion where you should contribute at any moment. In particular, those of you who have been talking to me over the past couple of days about these related issues, I told Howard Barnum this yesterday, although he's not here, unfortunately. If I skip over something interesting, say, wait, what about this? And so really, I want to talk about two different things. And they're tied together by the sort of overarching theme of what about continuous variables? What I mean by this is that a lot of the work on sick POVMs has been motivated and assisted by this discrete Heisenberg-Weil group. And the discrete Heisenberg-Weil group, let me just push this up there. These are two papers that I'm going to sort of ricochet off of over the course of this talk. And I'm going to switch gears halfway through. I suppose I should keep my clock out so I know when halfway is. And I'm going to start by talking about this more recent paper and then move on to a paper by some folks who are actually in the room. So the Heisenberg-Weil group is originally the group of translations on phase space. So I've got some R2 space indexed by X and P, and the Heisenberg-Weil group is generated by operators like translate, well, let me write it a different way, shifts in X are e to the minus I p hat delta X, and I could throw in h-bars here, but I'm just not going to when appropriate. And there's acceleration by a certain amount delta P, which is e to the minus I x hat delta P. And these operators move me around in phase space, with the interesting caveat that when I go around some closed path, like so, and the area inside of that is called little a, then I don't actually get back to exactly where I started from. I pick up a phase, which is a Berry phase, e to the minus I a over h bar. So this group was reinvented, if you will, for these discrete phase spaces to give a discrete Heisenberg-Weil group. So this is the original HW group. And the discrete Heisenberg-Weil group is where you define a d-dimensional Hilbert space. And then you get, by defining two operators analogous to X and P, a phase space on a grid. And so the Heisenberg-Weil group now consists of integer-valued translations in phase space, either across the lattice or up the lattice. And so I have this group of txp where x and p are in 0 to d minus 1. And as I'm sure that everybody in the room knows, this is the group that has primarily been used to generate sick POVMs. We still don't know exactly, well, I still don't know exactly why this group works so well. When we, back in 2001 or 2002, when we started playing around trying to generate these things from fiducial vectors, we used other groups as well that had similar properties, that formed, for instance, a basis of unitaries for the operator space. And almost none of those groups worked. In fact, if you look at nice unitary error bases, this is the only one that exists in all dimensions. In particular, it's the only one that generally exists in prime dimensions. And so, for various reasons, today when I use d as a parameter, I'm going to assume that d is prime. Yes. Absolutely no good one. It was 2001, and I was screwing around in Santa Barbara, not understanding a lot of the quantum information that was going on at the ITP workshop. And for some reason, I started asking the question, how could you pack vectors into a small Hilbert space so that they're as far apart from each other as possible? Stumbled onto the sick POVM, and then for absolutely no good reason said, I wonder if these things happen to have Heisenberg file symmetry. And so, of course, they do. And so this has been a really powerful tool in generating sick POVMs. But the original motivation for the Heisenberg file group is the continuous Heisenberg file group and phase space. So lately, I've been thinking about, well, continuous variables. And over here, we've got this Hilbert space CD. For phase space, the relevant Hilbert space is L2 of R, square integrable functions on the reals. And the elements of this are basically wave functions psi of x. So it's the kind of quantum mechanics that we learned way back in our, you know, sophomore year of college or whatever. But things get a little bit weirder. And so the first question that I want to tell you about today is a rather odd sounding one. Is infinity prime? Or possibly a multiple of 2. So if infinity is prime, then L2 of R ought to behave sort of like a d-dimensional space where d is prime. And if d is prime, then we have a bunch of nice things, the most important of which is that there exist d plus 1 mutually unbiased bases. On the other hand, if d is equal to 2 times, let's say, an odd number, then we only know of 3 mutually unbiased bases. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I know, in any number of this form, any d of this form, no more than 3 MUBs have been constructed. So in particular, in d equals 6, there's a lot of interest in figuring out whether there are only 3 mutually unbiased bases, or possibly as many as 7. And all the evidence so far leans toward there only being 3. I don't know.
There is a paper by Goff.
No, but the point is to have the dimension is a square for the construction. And therefore it's not 2 times something
odd. Okay, so then 26 was wrong, I remember. Okay.
It is.
Yes, you're right, square dimension.
So the, as far as I know, the conjecture is that if the prime factorization of the dimension, and again, somebody correct me on this, if D is equal to D1 to the R1, D2 to the R2, et cetera, et cetera, then...
P1 to the R1. Right, those are primes, right?
Sure. Each of the DIs is a prime. Then the number of mutually unbiased bases is known to be greater than or equal to the minimum of DI to the RI plus 1 over all I. But as
what Tian just mentioned, for certain squares, you can be despawned.
Ah, okay. All right, good.
That is this paper by Rochon and Bain.
Okay, good.
But it's far out and not really a good improvement, but there's some improvement.
Okay. So the question I want to ask then is, in L2 of R, do we have a whole bunch of mutually unbiased bases? Or do we have just three of them? And the reason that this is relevant to sick POVMs is that when I look at this discrete phase space and the Heisenberg-Weyl operators that are so useful for creating seeks, Chris would prefer, although in D equals 5, as I've drawn, there are in fact six mutually unbiased bases, then the mutually unbiased bases have a very nice form on this phase space. The discrete Wigner function for an element of the first of the six mutually unbiased bases in D equals 6 is just a line going horizontally. And this is an eigenstate of the discrete position operator. The second unbiased basis has eigenstates that look like vertical lines. And then the other four have eigenstates that look like diagonal lines, with the slight caveat that this one I can draw just as a line, but then I have to start doing sort of chess moves, the way that a knight moves. Start here, move up 2 over 1, up 2 over 1, up 2 over 1, there, etc. So these are the diagonal lines. And it's pretty easy to see that there are exactly D plus 1. So can I do the same thing in infinite dimensions? And I always sort of assumed that you could. In fact, that was the whole motivation for this. The way that you get these mutually unbiased bases is you start with the position basis and the momentum basis, and then you take the momentum basis and you start transforming it by applying the phase space skewing operators, which are just linear transformations on phase space. They take this whole grid and they crank it over like this. So the transformation, I'll borrow this, takes this grid and it maps it if I can do this right. All right, except for that one, it's pretty good. How did I screw that up? There we go. And then it wraps this around to get me back. So these are the phase-based skewing operations. Of course, they have a natural analog in continuous dimensions. You just take your plane for phase space and you go, shoot, and you transform a little square that looks like this into a parallelogram that looks like this. And there's no wrapping because this is a non-compact space. So what if I actually do this? The question is, do I in fact get the same set of many, many mutually unbiased bases that I got over there? And intuitively, here's my phase space. I should be able to draw these various bases. Here's momentum, here's position. As lines, sets of lines, of course, foliations, that look like this, and like this, and like this, and like this, et cetera, et cetera. Now I can get between these things, either using the skewings that I just described, or using rotations, which exist for L2 of R. They exist in continuous phase space. They're the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian generated transformations. Or I could also do it using those skewings. And these rotations don't exist in discrete, because there's no way to rotate except by 90 degrees a grid like that and map it onto itself. So there's an interesting question as to whether my bases should be the eigenbases of, I start with x and p, so these are the operators defining the basis, and then should the rest of them be of the form x cos theta plus p sine theta, or should they be of the form x, p, and then p plus alpha x, where alpha is the amount that I've skewed my phase space by. And the answer turns out to be sort of interesting. This is this paper by Weigert and Wilkinson. And Weigert and Wilkinson said something rather surprising to me, and for a long time I thought it was wrong, and then I realized that it's not wrong, but it is confusing. The difference is that in this one...
I mean, they're just different by a constant.
That's right. They are different by a constant. So I'll come back to that in a minute, because you skipped out on the part of my rant yesterday where I explained why that's important. It's one of those infinite dimensional things. So I'll come back to it in just a second. It looks like they're the same, but I'm going to claim that they're not.
So it makes a difference whether you evaluate things in pounds versus dollars.
It does. You wouldn't think so. So Weigert and Wilkinson claimed there are only Riemanns down to a bar, which means that this whole quest for describing continuous variables in a way that's just like the discrete is sort of doomed, if they're right. And here's the argument, essentially. If you consider the eigenbasis of position, well, this has eigenstates like this. If you consider momentum, its eigenstates are these. And of course, I'm not writing down anything terribly deep or useful here. And if I now take q sub theta to equal x cosine theta plus p sine theta, then this has eigenbasis states, just call it q. And now, these two bases are in fact unbiased. And the reason that they're unbiased is that they satisfy the condition . So in finite dimensions, so for some fixed d, the condition for unbiasedness is between two bases, bi and bj, is that for all psi in bi and phi in bj, the inner product of one basis element, one element from one basis and one element from another basis, is equal to a constant. And you can then show immediately that this constant has to be 1 over the square root of the dimension. Okay, so these are mutually unbiased. If you work this out, this is actually 1 over the square root of 2 pi h bar. Another one of those sophomore level quantum mechanics things. And I've run out of board space here, and this one doesn't go up. This one does. So x and p are unbiased. And in fact, x and q are also unbiased. If you work out what the inner product is, it's 1 over the square root of 2 pi h bar sine theta. and P and Q are unbiased. Their inner product is equal to a constant. Same thing as up to cos theta. And so what Weigert and Wilkinson said was, well, every pair of these is unbiased. But the three of them, for any q, do not form a set of mutually unbiased bases. So the statement is, the set, I'll write it this way, x, p, and q theta are not mutually unbiased because the absolute value of an inner product between x and q is not equal to the absolute value of an inner product between x and p. In other words, we have something that never happens in finite dimensions. We have two pairs of bases. Each pair is unbiased with respect to each other, but they have different inner products. Now, these two conditions, that the inner products are constant, they don't depend on which element of the basis you choose, and that the inner products are equal to 1 over root d, these are equivalent in finite dimensions. But in L2 of R, apparently they're not. So this is basically the question that I want to ask, and I still don't know the answer. Should we consider a set of bases, every pair of which is unbiased with respect to the other, but where different pairs have different constants for their inner product, should we consider those to be mutually unbiased bases or not? Now in particular, let me specialize. Let me give you a bit. I don't know the answer to that. I suspect that it's almost a definitional question, but let me give you a little bit more information to show how to constrain the problem. In other words, I hope you'll think about how to define this, but you shouldn't just shoot in the dark. So here's a bit more information that you need to make up your mind. Let me take this Q to be 45 degrees. So now I have three bases. I have X, P, and Q 45. Those of you who think in radians, 45, I know what it means, pi over 4, I tend to forget. The inner products between these things are not the same, and the reason is that this inner product is actually determined by the symplectic inner product between the symplectic vectors corresponding to the operator. What I mean by that is the symplectic inner product between P and X is the area of this triangle. And the symplectic inner product between Q and X is the area of a slightly different triangle. And those two triangles don't have the same area. Now, you may at this point be thinking, I don't really remember my infinite dimensional stuff all that well because I haven't thought about it since I started working in quantum information theory, but surely this is all crap. These inner products don't really have a meaning. They're not probabilities. And it's true that they're not probabilities, but they do have a meaning. I would be totally glad to go into the details of my conversion to realize that this distinction is meaningful in private. I will simply say that for a class I'm teaching this term, I ended up spending a lot of time researching rigged Hilbert space, which is where you go to rigorously define things like the eigenkets of position and momentum. And what I found is that they are rigorously definable, and that these inner products are not just sort of goofily made up. They are necessary, they are fixed by the following condition. So back in sophomore quantum mechanics, we all learned this, and for me at least, my instructor sort of waved his hands at it and said, well, this is this function that's infinity at zero and zero everywhere else. But it doesn't really exist. And so we just use it because Dirac was really smart. Well, actually, it's not a function. It's a distribution. It is a rigorously well-defined mathematical object. These inner products are between non-physical states, and so they don't have to represent probability amplitudes, and in fact, they don't. But they are valid distributions, which means you can integrate over these things, and you have to get certain results. And so this is the normalization condition for these states that are not physical states, but are well-defined eigenvectors of these operators. And when you take an inner product like this, if I had taken an inner product like that for some physical state psi, like an eigenstate of the harmonic oscillator, I would get a quantity whose absolute square was a probability measure over the reals. Now, when I take two non-physical states like this, I get a quantity whose absolute square is a measure, but not a probability measure. In fact, it's a Lebesgue measure. It's translationally invariant. This is what it means for two bases in an infinite dimensional Hilbert space like L2 of R to be unbiased, is that their inner product is proportional to Lebesgue measure. And so what we're seeing is that when I pick these different bases, I get something that's all, the inner products are always proportional to Lebesgue measure, but they have different proportionality constants. And the question is this physically meaningful? Should I just say, well, they are in fact mutually unbiased, the actual value of this inner product doesn't matter, in which case, indeed, every line that I take would correspond to an element of a set of mutually unbiased bases? Or should I demand that the inner products are the same? I'll throw one more monkey wrench in here. It seems like I've only constructed two mutually unbiased bases. I showed that according to this definition where the inner products all have to have the same magnitude, these three are not mutually unbiased. But Weigert and Wilkinson pointed out that there is a set of three that are mutually unbiased. And the set, so the one that's not is X, P, X plus P over root 2. However, here's a set that is, according to this more restrictive definition, that all the inner products have to be the same. XP, X plus P. And now we come back to Chris's excellent point. What the heck is the difference between between this and this? They only differ by a constant. Surely, operators that differ by a constant have the same eigenbasis. The answer is, well, sort of. They have the same eigenvectors up to a constant. The normalization is different. If I look at the eigenbasis of the operator X, then these satisfy the condition X, X prime equals delta of X minus X prime. But if I say, let X twiddle be the operator 2x, then this has an eigenbasis of states x twiddle, satisfying x twiddle prime equals delta x twiddle minus x twiddle prime. And since x twiddle is 2x, this is delta of 2x, minus x prime. And delta of 2x is different from delta of x by a factor of 2. In other words, these have to have a different normalization by a factor of 2 in order to satisfy the delta function normalization, which is not a trivial thing. A lot of the quantum mechanics that we do relies on that delta function normalization. So this is why, in fact, these are not mutually unbiased. They don't have the same inner products, but these do. They all have the same inner product, 1 over square root of 2 pi h bar. And I can draw a very similar diagram to that. And you'll notice that I drew all my vectors here as unit vectors. Now, if I draw the same diagram in phase space, since this is a bigger operator, it's no longer represented by a unit vector in phase space. Got a unit vector here, a unit vector here, and a longer one here. This is x plus p. And now if I start drawing triangles, something pretty cool happens. There's one triangle. There's another triangle. And I think I'm running out of colors of chalk, but there should be some white here. Here's my third triangle. These all have the same symplectic area. So the last thing I want to say, I think I've... Yep, I want to move on to my second topic momentarily. And again, this is really just, I'm trying to seed discussion here. I don't know the answer to this. The last thing I want to address is any of this even remotely physically relevant? Because I'm playing around here with bases, none of which include physical states. In other words, these states are not normalizable as probability measures. So is any of this physically relevant? Well, the first thing, let me digress very briefly from that. Let me explain to you why, if I want to construct mutually unbiased bases in L2 of R, I have no hope of doing it with physical states. In other words, the question is meaningless if we restrict ourselves to physical normalizable states. So let me just pick one basis, and let me suppose that that basis contains physical states. In order for them to be orthogonal, it must be a countable basis. So for instance, it could be the harmonic oscillator eigenbasis. And up to unitary transformations, it might as well be. So I have a countable basis of physical states. And now I want to define another basis that is unbiased with respect to that one. So let these be phi 1, phi 2, etc. And now the condition is that J phi k has to equal a constant that doesn't depend on j and k. But that means that if I take one of these states and I expand it out, phi k is a sum of something in this basis. All these constants, oh sorry, all these coefficients have to be the same. And this is a sum from k equals 1 to infinity. And so this is a constant C here. This either has to be 0, in which case this is not a state because its norm is 0, or it has to be a finite number, in which case this is not a state because its norm is infinite. Bang, my second basis has to consist of non-normalizable states. So I can't even get two unbiased bases without immediately going to unnormalizable states. So just give up. Chris, you look bothered.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Oh, sure. But the condition, okay, so this is CK. And the condition is that CK squared has to be a constant. Yeah, you're right. So, but what I was complaining about is that the absolute squares of these have to be either 0, in which case it's not a state, or a number, in which case it's not a state. You can't construct physical states that are unbiased with respect to the harmonic oscillator eigenstates. If you did, they would be eigenstates of phase. And it's been argued by Pegg and Barnett that there's an operator corresponding to phase, but it would have continuously denumerated eigenstates. And any operator whose eigenstates are continuously indexed always has non-physical, non-normalizable eigenstates. So that's point number one is, yes, we really do have to consider this. Now that I want to ask the question, is this physically relevant? Or are we just screwing around with things that we all learned back in sophomore year of quantum mechanics no real physicist should worry about? Nasty eigenstates of position and momentum. So let me make these things physical. Let me consider what would happen if I tried to physically construct something approximating these eigenstates of position and momentum and q. Well, the sort of obvious natural thing is to say I have my phase space is going to be kind of bounded. And so instead of states whose vigor function stretches off ad infinitum, it's going to be chopped. And the natural generalization is long, skinny Gaussians, squeezed states. So suppose that my eigenstate of momentum, position, let's say, so the twiddle here means approximate eigenstate of, has a form like this, long, skinny Gaussian. OK, this is physical. And my approximate, I'm rough on chalk. There we go. And momentum, I'll draw in a different color, long, skinny Gaussian. Now, the significance of that constant in front shows up here. The difference between an approximate eigenstate of momentum and, let's say, an approximate eigenstate of momentum over 2, or 2 momentum, you know, whatever, put any constant in there, is the length of the Gaussian. So these vectors that I was drawing in phase space correspond to the semi-major axis of this Gaussian. This one is an approximate eigenstate of P over 2, but this one is an approximate eigenstate of P. And now, the momentum and the position Gaussian have very small overlap. It's a pretty good ansatz to say that the overlap between them, the squared overlap actually, is going to be equal to the area of that little square where they actually overlap. I'm not going to try to prove that, but it turns out to be valid. So this has gotten a little cluttered. Let me draw another diagram. I've got 1, 2. Now I want to draw a third Gaussian corresponding to some direction in phase space, the approximate version of an eigenstate of that operator, that has the same overlap. And now that overlap, by the way, is indeed a probability. It's the probability if I measure a sort of coherent, if I make a coherent state measurement with these squeezed states, it's the probability of getting a given outcome, yada, yada, yada. So those of you who might think about, for instance, continuous variable teleportation or cryptography should be able to find an application, because these are actually physical quantities. Well, suppose that I draw, so this is P, this is X, and now I'm going to draw P plus X over root 2. And that's a Gaussian like that. If you start looking at the overlaps here, you see that the overlap between the X and the P Gaussian is determined by that square. But between, say, the X and the P plus X over 2 Gaussian, it's that square plus that extra area right there, which means that indeed these states are more correlated. If I want to get the same correlation between all three of these states, well, the way I can do it is by taking this P plus X over root 2 and replacing it by a longer, skinnier Gaussian corresponding to P plus X. And my diagram has gotten hopelessly complicated, but if you draw this on your own paper and you work out this area right here, you find that it's the same as the original of the square of the intersection of the X and P Gaussians. So now, challenge is, find a fourth Gaussian whose overlap with all three of these is the same as their mutual overlaps. If you do, that'll correspond to a fourth mutually unbiased basis in this stronger sense. This sense where not only do the abstract, idealized, infinite, unnormalizable basis states have to have the same overlaps, but also approximate eigenstates have to have the same overlaps. And as far as I can tell, you can't do it, and Weigert and Wilkinson are right. So, in conclusion, what I find intriguing about this is that
This seems to be a strong, there seem now to be two notions of mutually unbiased bases. One is that the basis states themselves, every pair is unbiased. But the other is that when you look at sort of approximate versions of those states, if you allow a little bit of fuzziness, then the unbiasedness is in some sense preserved. And for continuous variables, this ansatz allows me to make total sense of the idea that the basis P, and let's say P plus epsilon X, are in fact highly correlated, even though these bases are technically unbiased. And yet, if I look at approximate eigenstates of them, they're darn near the same. They have a tremendous overlap. And I think one way to see this is that delta x squared delta p squared is greater than or equal to h bar over 2. But if I take states, bases like these, then delta p plus epsilon x squared delta p squared is only greater than or equal to h bar, sorry, epsilon h bar over 2. So there seems to be a connection back to maybe the most fundamental thing in continuous variable physics. I hope I've confused you a bit. So my last point is actually much simpler. I want to move on and I want to talk about people here. So in this paper by Appleby, Dang, and Fuchs, it was suggested that the states in a Heisenberg-Weil sick POVM are like coherent states. Is that a fair evaluation? Sorry? No, no, oh, right, okay. So you only said this, but I don't, there's no equations here either. So, okay. So I want to argue, I want to give a vague notion in which
that's what we thought we had proven at first.
Yeah.
And then we realized we had a minus sign mistake.
Well, you know,
that's true.
Gross,
I mean,
and
really is true.
Gross and Wilczek got a Nobel Prize for a sign error.
A sign error on the statement 6 or like from your sense.
We thought we'd found maximum uncertainty.
Thanks, Paul. Well,
no, that's the exact point Robin wants to make.
And we were in that belief, state of belief, for about a month. And then we suddenly realized that we'd made a sign error.
So once they fixed their sign error, they found that, let's see, where do I have, I only need one more board, but I do need another board. There we go.
There you go.
I love perimeter. So the statement by ADF is that six states are minimum uncertainty. And the sense in which they're minimum uncertainty, let me see if I can do this from memory, but fortunately I have some good aids to memory right here, is that if you take your discrete phase space, and I'm not going to put grid lines on here because I don't want to be specific about what prime dimension this is, but then you start drawing lines corresponding to the mutually unbiased bases, like this. Of course, these wrap around because this is actually a torus. And you take each of these mutually unbiased bases to correspond to an operator, I'll just call it Q sub K. And then, so this operator has an eigenbasis, QK. And then if I define delta QK squared to be the Am I right about that? Am I going the wrong direction? Yeah, yeah, I'm going the wrong direction here.
Use gradient entropies instead of...
Yeah.
It's entropic.
Sorry?
It is entropic.
Yeah. So what is the definition? We decompose our state into state psi into this basis, and then I write these as probabilities. I'll just call this Q sub k of psi. No, I don't want to call it that. P sub psi of QK. And then I look at the purity of this. And I multiply.
You find that figure, take a little bit.
Right, so I'm going to multiply together. Sorry about the evolving notation. I said this is a workshop talk. So this will be in the first basis, the basis of Q1. And then I multiply this by the purity, if you will, the impurity in the second basis, dot, dot, dot. In the D plus 1 basis. And now I take a log of all this. This is an entropic quantity, which you call
total uncertainty or something like that.
Sure. Okay, I'm just going to call it S. And this is a measure of how uncertain I am about all these different bases. So it's related to the delta x squared, delta p squared sort of thing. But it's a different quantity. And this is minimal. For a fixed state. In other words, if you pick any other state, it will have total rending entropy over all these different bases bigger than for a Z state.
Yeah.
Or at least as big?
The Z states are minimal, but there are other minimal ones.
Okay. So Z states are minimal uncertainty states for this complicated rending entropy. And the reason that this makes sense is if you look in continuous variables at coherent states, then a coherent state is just a nice round Gaussian. And if you take any basis, well, you're just slicing along some direction in phase space, and you get a nice minimum uncertainty Gaussian distribution. And you compute this quantity, and you find that it is minimal, just as delta x squared, delta p squared is minimal. So the idea is that these are like coherent states in having minimum uncertainty in phase space. So I just want to point out a different conclusion that comes from a different analysis. Let me move over here, actually. Steve, what do I have, about 4 or 5 minutes here?
Yeah.
But I promised not to go longer than Chris. There we go.
I thought that was exactly on time.
Well, you were just using a different scaling constant for time.
You were just saying you didn't need to jam it.
So here is another property of coherent states. Consider the characteristic function. This is a really nice intuitive quantity. Take a state, psi, shift it in phase space by some distance x and some distance p. Project it back onto itself, and this gives me a function c of x and p. Now, the idea of a coherent state is that a coherent state is localized in phase space. If I project it by any substantial distance, if I translate it by any substantial distance, well, I start with some nice coherent state, then I move it over to here. That's my x and p. I get something that's very nearly orthogonal to the original state. As long as this distance is large, if the distance is small, then I get something that's not actually orthogonal to the original state. And in fact, for a coherent state, c of x and p is in the appropriate units equal to e to the minus x squared plus p squared
for h bar. Which is to say, if you move at a distance larger than square root of h bar, then you get something that's pretty much orthogonal. But close distances, you get something that's still pretty much the same as the original state. Now, if we go back to our sick POVM states, this, so now, let this be the state of a Heisenberg Weyl seek in finite dimensions. Now, TXP is an element of a discrete group, not a continuous group. And because these translations, in fact, generate the entire seek, this is just equal to the inner product between two different elements of the seek POVM, because this translation operator acting on the second one has generated a different element. And so this is, if I square these, this is equal to 1 over d plus 1, regardless of what x and p are. So the characteristic function, if I draw it on a grid, so here is the 0, 0 point, and I have 1 here, because that means I have, and you always have to have 1 at the origin for the characteristic function. And then every place else, I have 1 over d plus 1. Doesn't depend on how far you translate it. Contrast that with the case of the coherent state, which has a Gaussian profile. Translated by short distances, you get large overlap. Translated by large distances, you get increasingly small overlap. The coherent state is localized in phase space. It is much happier to be translated a short distance than by a long distance. Seek states, on the other hand, do not care how far they are translated. As soon as you translate them at all, bang, you become essentially orthogonal. Inner product 1 over d, as d gets large, that goes to 0. We might ask, are there states that have this property in infinite dimensions, in L2 of r? And the hand-waving answer is provided by a Nature paper, 2003, by Wojciech Zurek, who pointed out something that came as a surprise to some people, which is there are structures in phase space that have size smaller than h bar. And this is because, before they were sort of vaguely thought that by some people that h bar was the smallest length scale in phase space. And the example was a, we call it a compass state. Four coherent states superposed like this. So I'm drawing a Wigner function. In the middle, you get interference fringes. In a sort of a checkerboard fashion. And the size of these interference fringes, the size of a single square that's positive or negative in here, is area equals h bar over capital A, where capital A is determined by is the area of the whole state in phase space. And then what Wojciech pointed out was two things. The first is that as a result of this fine scale structure, if you translate the state by a very small amount, these fringes become negative interference with each other. They yield negative interference. And the state has a very rapidly decreasing characteristic function. The second thing he pointed out is that generically, if you have chaotic evolutions in phase space, you start with a coherent state, the chaotic evolution will smear the state all over some big energy surface, and you will get extremely high frequency fluctuations in the middle that lead to the same conclusion, which is fine scale structure and extreme rapid drop off in the characteristic function. What that means is that these states physically, for those of you who think about physics, are good states for building detectors. If you were to initialize a detector that's supposed to be a sensitive detector in one of these states, it would, under translation, drop, it would change to an orthogonal state. And so you could detect very small translations in phase space, very small boosts or shifts. A coherent state, on the other hand, is only sensitive to displacements on order of root h bar, whereas this is sensitive to displacements order of root h bar over the largest scale in x and p. So a seek state is much more like one of these states. It's delocalized over phase space. It is incredibly sensitive to the smallest possible translation in phase space. And in that sense, I would say that Sikh states are exactly the opposite of coherent states, which are localized in phase space, and Sikh states are maximally delocalized because their autocorrelation functions drop off as rapidly as possible. So the last thing that I want to say is this provides an interesting, provocative, probably hopeless question, which is, what would Sikh states, Heisenberg-Weil Sikh states, look like in L2 of R? We've already seen that mutually unbiased Bayesians are kind of problematic, but intriguing as well. I don't know what Sikh states would look like in L2 of R. I'm fairly certain that it's hopeless to build. I take that back. I'm fairly certain that they will be horribly ill-behaved. They will have to have fine structure at all scales. I suspect that they will be infinitely discontinuous, like a Cantor function or something. But I actually don't know. They will certainly have to be non-normalizable. Really open question. Thanks for your attention.
There is another class of minimal entropy states that have been studied by Wouters and Sussman, and Marcus Appelrad told me that it's possible to generalize them even to odd prime power dimensions. Wouters and Sussman was for dimension 2, 4, and so on. And they look more like a coherent state, at least in the Evan case. I don't know from.
In the odd prime power case too. They have rotational symmetry. So if you take a Clifford, I mean, in even prime power dimension, their eigenstates are the Clifford unitary of order d plus 1. So
that would be a skewing, though, not a rotation, right? Because there are no rotations.
Okay, yes.
So they have they're skew symmetric.
Yes, all right, yeah. But they've got a high degree of symmetry. I mean, I agree. I wouldn't want to call it coherent, really. They're very unlike coherent. I think that property, it's got a geometrical interpretation, which has struck me since we wrote that paper, in terms of generalized block space. Because in generalized block space, the MUBs form D plus one hyperplanes, which are mutually orthogonal. The MUB block vectors, rule line.
This is in Hilbert-Schmidt space, the operator space.
In operator space, the trace-free part of the operator space.
Right.
So you've got these hyperplanes. And the minimum uncertainty condition as we defined it there, which of course is quite unlike the uncertainty condition for coherent states in continuous variable case defined in terms of standard deviations.
Yep.
But anyway, what it means is that the block vector it has equal projection onto each of the MUB hyperplanes. So a minimum uncertainty state in that sense is as far from the MUB hyperplanes as it can get. It's as far from being, in some sense, an element of one of the mutually unbiased bases as it can be. So I don't know, I think that clarifies the meaning of it a bit.
Interestingly, the coherent state, so if you buy that directions in phase space do correspond to MUBs in continuous dimensions, at least in one sense, and I think that maybe the biggest message of the first part of my talk is there appear to be two different senses. There's not one of them that's right. Then coherent states are as close as possible to being an element of every basis.
Yes.
They're close to being an eigenstate of X. They're close to being an eigenstate of P. They're close to being an eigenstate of X plus P over root 2.
Yes.
Whereas these states are as far as possible from being.
Yes.
And so perhaps it's a little bit interesting that apparently both conditions, either as close or as far as possible, saturate the minimum uncertainty bound, the minimum uncertainty for the quantity that you looked at. It would be fascinating to ask what other states in continuous variables satisfy minimality of your Renyi entropy.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure obviously it's going to be, I suppose you could define it as an integral.
One would have to think very carefully.
you know, when you try to generalize.
I've got a feeling it might be a horribly ill-behaved quantity, that thing.
Perhaps.
So I always wonder if these things would be better thought of as maximal things in some sense. You know, I've also thought about, you know, are the six coherent states and so forth. And besides this, also notice, I mean, there's another way in which they're not, which is, so the coherent states of a Lie group usually have maximal isotropy subgroup, right? And these guys don't. If you let's think of the Heisenberg Weyl group as a Lie group, which it might even be a group at any time. But if you look at the, you know, maximal tori in there, I mean, the things that look like coherent states with respect to that might be the Mohs states. And sort of the analogy of uncertainty might be to, you know, not to add up all the bases, but you just sort of find the best bases look at the uncertainty in that. And these guys were such that, I would guess, I don't know. But for instance, if you looked at all the Mohs, you'd be pretty spread out in all of them. The six states would be pretty spread out in all of them. So maybe they're sort of like maximal uncertainty states. And I'll throw out one more idea. This is somebody asking about Fyashkov last night. So there's this thing called geometric invariant theory, which you can use to do things like, let's try to make the set of orbits of a Lie group or something into, I think this is roughly what you use it for, into an algebraic variety. And so there's some nasty orbits that you have to throw out, and it's kind of technical. But so Klyachko was saying if you take the Lie group that's like a product of two local SUs or SLs, let's say, so it's like the Lie group of a bipartite quantum system. Well, the unentangled states turn out to be the coherent states of that representation, and they're also what a bunch of us who wrote a similar paper called generalized unentangled states. But Klyachko focused a lot of attention on the EPR states, the maximally entangled states, which he claimed were, I guess, maximal uncertainty. Which I guess kind of makes sense if you look, they've got maximum extensity matrices. But these states are apparently some special orbit in geometric invariant theory. So just wacky idea, maybe the six are the same kind of special orbit for the Heisenberg Weyl group, if we can figure out whether there is or
not. Let me adopt speaker's privilege actually here to ask a question of the audience, specifically David.
Yes.
from what Howard was just saying, what if I were to throw out the crackpot idea that there's some connection with what with your Pi Kudos yesterday? That what Howard was saying is that the, in some sense, minimally and maximally entangled states or generalized entanglement states have similar properties, certain similar properties. I think you argued in Pi Kudos yesterday that maximally entangled cluster, you know, multi-party states are just as useless for quantum computing as minimally entangled ones.
Yeah, of course, but I've chosen my entanglement measure carefully to support my thesis.
And also, it's not true in general, depending on what task you want to perform, right? If you want to use a maximum entangled state or a random state to teleport, then it's actually quite good.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it depends on what questions you ask. David was asking about measurement-based form computation there. So maybe for certain questions, there might be some duality.
Well, I think that's, I mean, Howard was saying for certain measures, right?
Yeah,
measures correspond to questions. There are many measures of uncertainty. There are at least two measures of mugness, I think, et cetera. So I'm just wondering if there could be a connection.
I mean, I think what I was trying to emphasize was that I think for the measure of uncertainty that might be the right analog to the uncertainty measure for Lie groups, according to which coherent states are minimal uncertainty, it might well turn out that six states are maximum uncertainty. Because I think that measure is probably going to be one that picks out the most states. Right? I mean, those are the eigenstates of maximum quotas. Sort of simultaneous eigenstates of a maximum community subgroup of Heisenberg Weyl group.
So your measure here is something like the minimum over all the MUGs of the entropy?
Yeah, perhaps. Or I would just use the quadratic entropy, because that's much similar to what you do.
Right. Whereas theirs was a product of all the quadratic entropy.
This is like, yeah, this is basically
a sum. It's really a sum of
except the log. It's like adding the quadratic entropy.
Yes. But if you don't take the log, then it's the product of all the purities. And I thought that's what you meant by quadratic entropy.
No, I mean, but if you do it for a Lie group, you find the Cartan subalgebra. I mean, yeah, you basically wind up finding the basis, or in more general, it's the Cartan subalgebra, in which the sum of the square expectation values of those things is the least if you're minimizing entropy. So you just like pick out the basis here with the minimum entropy.
Right.
You wouldn't add them up. And then I think you would see that you can't get the 6 to be low entropy in any of those basis. So I haven't done the calculation.
Interesting. Okay, well, lots of interesting questions there. Let's thank Rob again.